So yesterday we started a discussion about how we called it, what is Vedic astrology, but actually it's just basically introductory topics, concepts associated with Vedic astrology, give the underpinning before you get into the real mechanics of the subject, which we're actually are not going to do because it's a 7-year study at minimum. After 30 years, I'm still studying. So, one of the misconceptions that people have about astrology, that it's about your karma. Astrology is not about karma. Astrology is a language which describes everything. Now, if you're a person who has karma, then it's going to describe your karma. If you don't have karma, it's not going to describe your karma. It's a descriptive language, a very sophisticated language, but a language. It's not about, if you're about karma, then that's what it's describing. But it is not about karma. It's like English. You know, in the Bhagavatam, it's the same English language is used to describe people who don't have karma. Like Krishna, Radha, and also describe people who do have karma. But the English is not about karma. The people may or may not have karma. But English doesn't have karma. So astrology is not about karma. It's about describing things according to the time factor. It is a time factor. It's a kala vidya. It's a language, it's a science of time. And time is an energy of Krishna. Kalosmi aham. Time I am, destroyer of the worlds. And I have come to destroy all people. And it is the time factor which is what creates the material energy. The time factor. The time factor is what get the sound level okay now.
Yeah. That's why I said you put it louder.
Whatever, make it as loud as people can stand it. We have to. I'm surprised anybody came at all. I almost couldn't make it through the crowd. The time factor. It is Krishna's energy. It is Krishna's Shakti. And it is what agitates the Pradhan. The Pradhan is the unmanifested material nature. It is in neutral state. It's eternal. But when Krishna wants to, he manifests his Kala Shakti. It agitates the Pradhan, creating the Trigunas. And it also simultaneously separates the energies into material and spiritual energy. So the material energy is separated away from the material energy. Srila Prabhupada gives an example, a tape recorded conversation. He was actually, one time he was walking, I think in Cheviot Hills or on the beach in Los Angeles, and they had backup tape recorders. So they were both recording Srila Prabhupada's voice. And so he said, separated energy just like my tape recorded voice, and then you hear, he said, now stop one of the tape recordings and rewind it and play it back, and you hear Srila Prabhupada's voice, and he says, that's my separated energy. That's separate energy, isn't it? Yeah. It's because he's listening to himself speak. That's to give you a rough idea of what he means by separated energy. So astrology is a very sophisticated language, a symbolic language which can describe anything. Anything. God, or, you know, and from God downwards, because Gargamuni was able to tell everything about Krishna, Lord Chaitanya had his horoscope, told everything about him, including his previous incarnations. Of course, Lord Chaitanya, being the covered incarnation and being a little bit of a joker, after the Sarvagya described all his incarnations, said, actually, no. In my last life, I was a cowherd boy, and because of the punya of taking care of cows, I took birth as a Brahmin in this life. So he was telling the truth, at the same time he was joking, because he was a cowherd boy in his last life. He was Krishna. But he didn't quite spell it out that way. So that's one big misconception. It's not, astrology is not about karma. You may be about karma, but astrology is not about karma. So it's both a symbolic language and it's also a very sophisticated clock. It's like if we know from the time you're born, we can create your horoscope. It's got But it's like this clock over there has got 3 hands. Horoscope has got 10 hands on it. It's got Saturn. It takes him 30 years to go around. Rahu, Ketu, they go 18 years and they go backwards. Imagine you had a clock where the hands go backwards. You know. And Jupiter takes 12 years to go around. Mars, 2 years. Sun, Venus, and Mercury. Sun, 1 year, and Venus and Mercury very close to the Sun. The Moon goes around the clock in 1 month, and the Lagna goes around in 1 day. In 1 day. So just as we can calculate your chart from the time you're born, if you give somebody a horoscope, I can tell you when they were born. One person was trying to be very clever. They didn't want to reveal when they were born. But in the due course of conversation on the internet, they were revealing what their planetary positions were. So I calculated they were born at such and such a time, and I sent them, and they were shocked. I had been able to calculate their birth year, date, and time to within 10 minutes. So it's just a big clock. It's a timing device. The timing devices don't cause things to happen. They time. That's like that clock times when, you know, 4:30 is going to be Mangal Arti. At 5 o'clock in the afternoon there's going to be rush hour. But it doesn't cause rush hour. So that's, you have to keep that always separated. Astrology doesn't cause anything to happen. It describes. Languages don't cause the things which they're describing. That, got everybody got that? The newspaper, when it says the stock market fell, the newspaper article didn't cause the stock market to fall. Of course, somebody might write something which gets everybody frightened. That's another thing. And they rush to sell everything, but that's something else. It's like some people may make predictions which frighten people, self-fulfilling prophecies. Okay. And sometimes people think that because you can able to predict something, that this somehow robs people of their independence. We're going to discuss in more detail fate, free will, and the law of karma after this. I just want to give a little brief introduction because the topic of fate, free will, and the law of karma is going to be long. We might not be able to finish it this evening. We'll leave it for some other time. But to give an indication, there's one story. The life of Kalidas. Anybody ever heard of Kalidas? He wrote Meghadoot, Kumara Sambhava, Shakuntala. So he was, before he became Kalidas, he was a complete idiot. He was a murka. So what happened, the apocryphal story was that there was a princess who was a pundit. And she would only marry somebody who could defeat her in debate. So many Brahmins, many pundits, they came to win her hand in marriage, and they were all defeated and went away with their, you know, their heads hung down. So one of the defeated pundits, he was walking, and he went by this tree, and he could see this man sitting in the tree on a branch of the tree, and he was sawing the branch between him and the tree, right? And the pundit said, stop that. If you do that, you're going to fall out of the tree. But the guy was the man was a total murka, you know. You shouldn't, if you give, as a saying, you give murka upadesha, but they give good instructions to a fool, they just bite you. So that's what happened. The murka, he started blasting the pundit, saying, leave me alone, it's none of your business, what do you know anyway, etc., etc., etc. And then the pundit said, yeah. Murka. Then he just kept walking away. As he could see, as the idiot kept sawing the tree, suddenly there's a big loud crashing sound, and the guy fell out of the tree, and he was seeing stars, and he said, wow, he predicted that I would fall out of the tree. He must be a great astrologer. He could see the future. So he ran. He was really stupid. Then he ran up to him and he touched his feet and said, oh, you're a great astrologer, you could see my future. And the pundit said, oh, he is really stupid, really stupid. But he could fit into my plan of revenge, because he was thinking how to revenge his defeat at the hands of the princess. So he told the murka, did you just do whatever I say? and I'll gain you great riches. And he dressed him up like a pundit, and he brought him back to the court of the king, and he told his protege, the idiot, don't say anything, just keep your mouth shut, don't say a word, let me do all the talking. So he brought the pundit, the pundit brought this idiot, and he said to the king, I have my friend here is a great scholar. He wants to debate your daughter, but he only engages in silent debates. No words can be spoken in a debate. Silent debate. Does your daughter accept the challenge? So the king brought the proposition to his daughter, and she was thinking, I never had a silent debate before. He must be a great scholar. Only a great scholar could do something like that. So she went for it, because she wanted to marry a great scholar. Like that. So then the next day they had the debate. No words, So she thought that she would start, So she stuck up one finger. And then the idiot, he stuck up two fingers. Then she thought for a while, then she admitted defeat. Everybody was shocked. She was defeated. Right? So then she went to her room, he went to his room, and the king asked his daughter, says, what happened? How did you come defeated? And she said, well, I poked out my finger indicating that everything is one. The non-duality, one. But when he poked out two fingers, he reminded me that actually there's two. There's Atma and Paramatma. So therefore I'm defeated. So then in the other corner, in the other room, the pundit said, what happened? He said, well, she stuck out one finger. She said she's going to poke me in the eye. I said, you poke me now, I poke you in both eyes. that's what happened. So the pundit says, great, now I'm going now. So he left. So then they got married. The princess got married to the idiot. Then after the marriage, she found out what the real story was, that she was married to a complete idiot. Not very bright, his shoe size was bigger than his IQ. So she was having a hard time dealing with this. she was trying to be a very chaste wife, but she had a difficult time in controlling her temper, and she was being critical of him, and all things that wives should not do, no matter how bad their husbands may be. So he was also feeling very bad that he was such an idiot. So he decided to go. He went to the Kali temple. And he was praying to Kali, etc. like that. And then after some time, he didn't come back for a long time. And then when he came, then at a certain point in time, he got darshan of Devi. And she asked, what did he want? He said, please make me into a real pundit. A real scholar. So I said, okay, no problem. He became a pundit. When he came back from the temple, he was like effulgent. In the meantime, his wife was thinking, well, by fate, I got married to this idiot. So that she just decided to bite the bullet and just to be as good a wife as she possibly could and not criticize her husband anymore. But then when she saw him coming, and he was so glowing and effulgent, And when she addressed him, he spoke in perfect Sanskrit. Before he could barely struggle with the Prakrit, that she was like stunned. And when he was speaking to her, not only was he speaking in perfect Sanskrit, but he was speaking in shlokas, in different meters, anushtup, trishtup, all different meters. And she was like, her eyes, she was dazzled. That while her husband is like, he's like a mega scholar, a maha scholar, and then she was addressing him as husband. But then he said, well, actually, because it was only because of you that I went there. So you're like my guru, and how I can be married to my guru. So he wanted to dissolve the relationship. And so his wife got really ticked off. And so then she cursed him that he would die at the hands of a woman, which is what happened later on. He was murdered by a woman. That's a long story. We won't get into that. So the point being, the introductory part of that story was that just because you can predict the future doesn't mean anything, actually. It's like a parents can predict that their child in diapers who are very angelic. So many times I meet devotees, so, oh my son is such an angel, you know, he's such a pure devotee, he's 8 years old. I always say, wait till puberty. Then tell me if he's still an angel, you know, still a pure devotee. And you have to, you know, don't need a weatherman to see which way the wind is blowing. It's not a big deal to be able to predict. So just because you predict something doesn't mean you've taken away their free will. Not a question of fatalism. It's just knowing what the signs are. So yesterday there were quite a few questions regarding fate, karma, destiny. You know, what's the point of doing anything if it's all fated, right? So often, you know, this, if, what's the point of doing anything that's all fated? This means everything is fated. You have no free will. Well, we do have free will. And if everything is fated, that means in your previous life it was fated. Or give you a better example. When I often get, oh, I met such and such person. It's like we were from lovers, from soulmates from the previous life. I get this all the time, you know. So that means, well, why couldn't it have been of this life? Why did it have to be of the past life? Why couldn't it just be of this life? You know, and if it was the past life, then in the past life you would have said it was from the previous life before, and etc. And it becomes the fallacy of the infinite regress. I mean, that nothing ever happens for the first time. It's always from before. But that keeps going on regressively until then. So things actually do happen for the first time, believe it or not. So this, if we just go into the idea that everything is fated and we have no free will, it leads to absurd conclusions. I'll just read something from some things I wrote before. Because this debate between fate and free will is not new. It was in the ancient Mediterranean. There was, like in the ancient Mediterranean world, there was a long-ranging philosophical controversy between fatalists, headed by Stoic philosophers like Zeno, Seneca, Epictetus, Diogenes of Babylon, Posidonius, etc., along with their allies who were the Hellenistic astrologers. The Hellenistic astrologers were totally fatalistic. Hellenistic means the Greeks and the Roman followers. And then there were the champions of free will. The forces of free will were led into battle by the leaders of the schools of the Platonists, the Skeptics, the Cynics, Epicureans, the Peripatetics, who were the Aristotelians. And there were men such as Plotinus, Cicero, Lucretius, Carneades, etc. These different schools, though they were divided on many points, they were united against the fatalists. So, this battle between fatalists and free will was some emperors would be fatalists and others would be free will. You know, like, for example, Marcus Aurelius, he was totally into fatalism. He was a Stoic philosopher himself, and he was very heavily leaning toward the teachings of Epictetus. He was so fatalistic in his attitude that he accepted his fate without fear, and thus was neutral to consulting even to oracles. But what would be the purpose if it was already fated to be so? Totally fatalistic. But then, just to give you arguments against fatalism. The best way to understand the weakness in fatalism is to see how its detractors attacked it, often by forcing it to absurd logical conclusions. In mathematics or in logic, this is called reductiones ad absurdum. You reduce something to an absurd till it becomes an absurdity. Therefore, it's, you know, that's how you prove the square root of 2. That was done by that method of reduction to absurdity. So we'll take an excerpt from Zeus Karatkais by Lucian, who was a Greek writer of the 2nd AD. So in this piece, Zeus, everybody know who Zeus is? Zeus. He was equivalent of Indra. That was the highest god according to the Greeks and the Romans. So he's being interviewed by Syniscus, who is a cynic, and their discussion is about the afterlife of the dead. So Syniscus says, I hear that somebody named Minos, a Cretan, acts as a judge in matters down below. He ought not to reward or punish anyone. And Zeus says, why not? And Saniska says, because we men do nothing of our own accord, but only at the behest of some inevitable necessity. If a man slays, it is she who slays. And if he robs temples, he only does it under orders. Therefore, if Minos were to judge justly, he should punish destiny instead of Sisyphus, and fate instead of Tantalus. For what wrong did they do in obeying orders? It's just their destiny. They have no free will. So even if you do some horrible crime, it's not your fault, is it? It's fate. So then another one. This is the 13th dialogue of the dead. In this case, the judge Minos is directly confronted by the same cold logic by Sostratus, a robber, a murderer, who boldly argues his case against the supreme judge of the dead. So Sostratus says, whatever I have done during my life, have I done it by my own free will, or has fate spun the thread of my actions? And Minos replies, doubtless, fate has spun it. And Sostratus says, saints or sinners, we then are but the agents of its will. And Minos says, certainly, you obey Clotho. She ordains at the moment of everyone's birth what each has to do. And Sostratus says, but if a man is forced to kill another without the power to resist the one from which he receives this order, who shall accuse him of murder? In the present case, if a slave on order of his master brings gold or silver to someone, who shall be listed as the benefactor? And Minos says, the master, Sostratus, the carrier is but his agent. Sostratus says, thus you see how unjust it is to punish us, who have only carried out Clotho's orders, and to reward those who merely bestowed a blessing which was not their property. Truly one must say that we did not have the chance to resist orders which were given to us by such fatal strength. So basically, that means nobody has any responsibility. Is blame it on fate, blame it on your karma, blame it on your planets, of course. It's because of the planets that you're acting this way. That's all bogus. It's like going to, go to a doctor, they take an x-ray, and there it shows your broken rib. Right? So should they just scratch out the crack in the x-ray and everything will be okay? Is because the x-ray shows you have a broken rib, do you have a broken rib? Or because you have a broken rib but the x-ray shows that way? It's because you have a defect, your horoscope shows up that way. Not because the horoscope is that way that you have the defect. Got it? It's not the planet's fault. It's not the x-ray's fault that you have a broken rib. It's your own responsibility. It's just describing you. You don't like the description, so you blame it the describer. It's not it doesn't work that way. It doesn't get you off the hook. So let's go. So that's how fatalism. Of course, not everything. We haven't got absolute free will. We have Krishna is satyasankalpa. We only have a tiny amount of free will because there is an element of fate and destiny is there. It's both. It's that life is an interplay of both fate and free will. Our fate. What is our fate? Our fate is our karma. Our karma creates, we'll read. What does it say in the Bhagavad Gita? The definition of karma. First of all. In Bhagavad Gita, it says, the word karma is derived etymologically in Sanskrit from the word kri, to create, to make. Thus karma relates to both to action and the fruits or results of our actions. The Bhagavad Gita 8.3 gives a concise definition of karma. Listen very carefully. The Supreme Personality of Godhead said, the indestructible, transcendental living entity is called Brahman, and his eternal nature is called Adhyatma, the self. Now listen, this is the important part. Action pertaining to the material bodies of the living entities is called karma, or fruitive activities. It is in relationship to the material body, subtle and gross. The soul doesn't get karma. The soul doesn't get karma, good or bad. You only experience karma if you're focusing on your body. If you're attached to your body, then you suffer. Then you're experiencing karma. If you're not focusing on your body, on your gross or subtle body, you're not experiencing karma. You're not. It's the body, the temporary body. That's why karma is temporary, because the body is temporary. It's not eternal, because the material body is not eternal. It goes away. So if we focus, if we are attached to our gross and subtle body, then we will experience karma, because the gross and subtle body is experiencing karma, but we are not experiencing karma. The soul doesn't experience, only the body does. That's the very that's an extremely, extremely important part. So there's, everybody knows this, basically there's three types of karma, three types of activity. This is good karma, bad karma, and nice karma, which is devotional service. But there is a further further definition or further categorization of karma. Let me just get to that section. And this is explained in the Upanishads. We're going to be reading from from the Vedanta Sutra. It will be discussions from the Baldev Vidyabhushan's commentary on the Vedanta Sutra, which will give some quotations from Upanishads and backed up by Srimad Bhagavatam and Bhagavad Gita. Okay. So, aside from the categorization of karma into good, bad, and akarma, there is, karma is divided into three other main categories, which is not to do with the positive or negative effect, but more has to do with the timing of the karma. There's sanchinta karma and kriyamana karma. And sanchinta karma itself is divided into two subcategories, arabdha and prarabdha karma. Now, sanchinta karma is the sum total of all your past karma, the complete enchilada, the whole thing. That's your, all previous karma is called sanchinta karma. And kriyamana karma is the newly created karma, because you can make new karma. The to give a very concise explanation of this is that life is an interplay of both fate and free will. By the by performing an activity, it creates a reaction. That by all the different reactions together create a certain type of environment, and that environment then produces different options, and then we can, we have the choice between option A and option B. Once you make that choice, you do not have the choice to accept the or reject the reaction. You have to accept the reaction, and that new reaction creates a new environment, you know, like that. And ultimately, the two options are the option which leads you closer to Krishna, and the option which takes you away from Him. That's what, and I'll give you a more, perhaps you could say, concrete example. Suppose somebody was born in an economically deprived situation, a ghetto, some basti, the barrio. So they have a poor situation. So they could decide, well, I could maybe get an education, work really hard, uplift myself, like that. Or they could say it's all society's fault. You know, I'm a minority, the majority is suppressing me, you know, down with the establishment, etc., etc., and take up a life of crime. I deserve that money, whether they, take up a life of crime, begin robbing stores, robbing people. Like that, that's a choice you make. Now, eventually, people who rob, they eventually get caught. So then, the reaction is, you go to jail. You, by your choice, you created a situation where you go to jail. Now, in jail, though you're in jail, you still have choices. You could, there's so many other criminals there, so you could learn from them what their mistakes were so that you don't make the same mistakes. You just, it's like a higher educational level of criminals, you know, it's like a big criminal education facility. Or you could decide, well, I was a mistake to become a criminal. I should try to rehabilitate myself, and I can, you know, I can get an education while I'm in school, or while I'm in jail, to, so that when I get out, I can do something. You always have a choice. You can always do something progressive, even though while you're in jail, your, you know, your environment is restricted, but you still can make choices which are progressive. That's your choice. But you made choices which put you into the jail to create that environment. But you still have choices, even in that negative situation, to make it worse or to get out. So you always remember, you always have free will. So now, Sanchinta karma is the sum total of all karma. It's divided into two portions. Arabdha, which is the total potential karma, and Prarabdha, which is karma which has already been put into action. What that means, suppose you went over to the English Channel, right? You had a glass in your hand, and you pull out a glass of water. The rest of the English Channel is like your Arabdha karma. It's the potential. It's in potential state. And the Prarabdha karma, would be symbolized by the glass in your water in your hand, that water has been taken. That karma has now been put into action. Because you can't live, all your karma can't manifest at once because there's so much of it. You can only take a little bit at a time. It's already been fructified. It's like the seeds. It's now germinated and now it's starting to fructify. Whereas other seeds are still in the warehouse, they haven't been planted even yet. But you have like a big warehouse, a very large warehouse, and you only took out a little bit. So, by performance of bhakti yoga, what is it that's destroyed? The karma is destroyed. But which karma is destroyed? It's the karma which is in potential, rather the karma which is destroyed. Because sometimes people say, well, why I'm a devotee, why I have so many difficulties, why I got an accident, broke my leg? Because by performance of devotional service, or even by the getting initiated, it is the Arabdha karma, the karma which is in potential, that is what is destroyed. It's like wood is turned into ashes by the action of fire, but not the Prarabdha karma. Prarabdha karma is not destroyed, because if it were destroyed, your body would fall off. Anybody get a mirror? Can I get a mirror here? If you look in the mirror, you'll see Prarabdha karma. That is, you know, this hit yourself. That's Prarabdha karma. If it gets destroyed, it means your body falls off. As soon as you get transcendental knowledge, or suppose at the time of initiation, the Prarabdha karma would be destroyed, that means you die and go back to Godhead. Who's going to want to get, you know, you see a bunch of people sitting on a fire sacrifice, and at the last swaha, everybody just falls over dead. You might think twice about getting initiated, you know, like, who's next? You know, like, what was in that purple Kool-Aid anyway, you know? So, Krishna is very intelligent. The Prarabdha karma is not destroyed, because then as soon as one achieves Brahma Vidya, no one would be able to, the person would leave his body, go back home, back to Godhead, and no one would be left to teach the Brahma Vidya. No one would be left to teach transcendental knowledge, because as soon as they achieve it, they leave their body. That doesn't work too well. You know, who's going to be around to teach it? Because as soon as they get it, they die and leave and never come back again. So Krishna, you know, though bhakti is potent enough to destroy Prarabdha karma, Krishna doesn't allow it to happen for a very practical consideration. It would look kind of funny, you know, people started dying in Sankirtan and then doing their initiation ceremony. So, even though Prarabdha Karma is not destroyed, depending upon the level of the devotee, different things happen. If we're not so advanced, then we have to tolerate. There's that one verse. Let me see if I can find it here. It's a Tate Nukam Pamsu Samikshamano. That's that verse. I can't find it immediately. Yeah. Tate Nukam Pamsu Samikshamano Bhunjana Evatma Kritam Vipakam Kridvag Vapur Vir Vidadhan Namaste Jivate Yo Mukti Pade Sadhaya Bhak. My dear Lord, one who earnestly waits for you to bestow your causeless mercy upon him, all the while patiently suffering the reactions of his past misdeeds and offering you respectful obeisances with his heart, words and body, is surely eligible for liberation, where it has become his rightful claim. That's Srimad Bhagavatam. That's the prayers of Lord Brahma. Srimad Bhagavatam, 10th canto, 14th chapter, verse 8. So, if we're not very advanced, then we simply have to tolerate the situation. Yeah, and still, even though we're suffering, we know it because it's our own fault. And we even think, Prabhupada describes such a devotee, he thinks even the punishment that we're getting is not as much as we deserve. We deserve much more. Krishna is only giving us a token. And it's a fact. Krishna does give us a token to remind us that the material world is not a nice place. Otherwise we might become a little complacent, oh, we're so happy in kirtan and this and that, and this world isn't so bad after all, you know. But then, you know, you lose your job. Or, you know, you get really sick, or you get an accident. You know, just to remind you that this is not really our home. This is not our home. And as an impetus, Krishna designed the world so that it is perfectly imperfect, so that we don't want to stay. But more advanced devotees, they are not aware of that they even have a body. It's like the Prarabdha Karma is singed, like a singed cloth. See this cloth? Or maybe if you've seen it with paper, a newspaper. If you burn a newspaper and you don't disturb it, you can actually, from the ashes, you can actually read the words. You ever have that? You ever see that? You can actually read the words, read the newspaper. But if you just touch it or blow on it, the whole thing just crumbles, turns into powder. But it looks solid. Right, so that's what happens to very advanced devotees. They still, the Prarabdha Karma is still there, but it's like a singed burnt cloth. You can still see the warp and the woof, but if you touch it, it just turns into powder, or like a newspaper, it just turns into powder, but it appears to be solid. So it's described in the third canto, both in the third canto and in the 11th canto, a description of... Well, first we'll read from the Bhagavad Gita, 6th chapter, 20th verse to 23rd verse. This perfectly describes a Jivan Mukta. Jivan Mukta, somebody who is, though they're in the body, they're muktas. In the stage of perfection called trance or samadhi, one's mind is completely restrained from material activities by practice of yoga. This perfection is characterized by one's ability to see the self by the pure mind and to relish and rejoice in the self. In that joyous state, one is situated in boundless transcendental happiness, realized through transcendental senses. Established thus, one never departs from the truth, and upon gaining this, he thinks there is no greater gain. Being situated in this, in such a position, one is never shaken, even in the midst of greatest difficulty. This indeed is actual freedom from all miseries arising from material contact. So now if we remember, near the earlier, I described from 8th chapter, I think 13th verse, that Krishna describes that karma is pertaining to the material body. So here it explains that what happens when you're actually seeing yourself, you're focusing on your real true self and the Atma and the Paramatma, and not focusing on the illusory gross and subtle body, which is impermanent, which is not you, then you're free. You can have total freedom. This indeed is actual freedom from all miseries arising from material contact. Material contact means our gross and subtle body. The subtle body means our mind, intelligence, false ego. The false ego is to that part of us which makes us think that we are the body. So if you're able to overcome that, then you have no more misery. Because the misery, the karma, good or bad, is only associated with the material body. And as long as you think you're the material body, gross or subtle, you will have to get karma. You'll have to experience that karma. But if you don't, folk, if you're not identifying yourself as the gross or subtle body, then you're free. Though you may have a body. And you're not shaken in spite of the greatest calamity. That's the plus point. That's what we have to get to. So it's like Srila Prabhupada, Hari Shari tells how Srila Prabhupada had a major toothache, and his jaw was like all swollen up. And Srila Prabhupada didn't think anything of it. And when he got up one day and his tooth had fallen out, anybody else would be like in misery. They'd be calling for dentists, doctors, operations, local anesthetic. Prabhupada, his whole like side of his face was like doubled up. And he just put a little bit of cloves in there. And then when he woke up one morning, his tooth had fallen out. He just didn't pay any attention. Or, was it because anybody seen that movie? What's it called? The Final Lesson? What is it? I only saw it once. Once was enough. When she did, on Prabhupada's deathbed, he's dictating, he's translating the Srimad Bhagavatam. He's practically, you know, it's a skeleton. And he's still. Doctors and anybody else in his condition would be screaming in agony. And he's instead of dictating Srimad Bhagavatam. So, not aware of the body. You know, the Bhagavad, Mahabhagavat is not aware of his body. This is from the Srimad Bhagavatam, 3rd canto, 28th verse, verses 28th chapter, verses 34 to 39. This is by Kapila teaching Devahuti. They're describing how the yogi, who gradually develops pure love of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, in the course of his progress in devotional service, the hairs of his body stand erect, excessive joy, he's constantly bathed in a stream of tears, occasioned by intense love. Gradually, even the mind which he used as a means to attract the Lord, as one attracts a fish to a hook, withdraws from material activity. So he goes on to explain all this, describe all these things. Then he says, because he has achieved his real identity, the perfectly realized soul has no conception of how the material body is moving or acting. Just as an intoxicated person, like up there, you see some of them, they're not aware of. Their pants are hanging down, you know. they put lipstick on, you know, like, got lipstick over her chin. She's not quite seeing. So they're not aware. Person cannot understand whether or not he has clothing on his body. The body is such a liberated yogi, along with the senses, is taken charge of by the Supreme Personality of Godhead. It's like, you're driving and you fall asleep at the wheel and your passenger, Paramatma, grabs the wheel because you're like, we just went into ecstasy. So Paramatma grabbed me. He's like, you know, Atma and Paramatma, they're always together, right? So when Atma finally realizes what he's, when he becomes Krishna conscious, he's still in the body, and it's, which is a vehicle. And he's, you know, basically he passes out, and the Paramatma has to take control. That's what it says, that's what Kapila Dev says. So the body of such a liberated yogi, along with the senses, is taken charge of by the Supreme Personality of Godhead and its functions until its destined activities are finished. The destined activities means the prarabdha karma. That's the destined activities. The liberated devotee, being awake to his constitutional position and thus situated in samadhi, the highest perfectional stage of yoga, does not accept the byproducts of the material body as his own. Thus he considered his bodily activities to be like the activities of the body in a dream. In the purport, Prabhupada makes the following point. So the following questions may be posed. As long as a liberated soul is in contact with the body, why don't the bodily activities affect him? Doesn't he actually become contaminated by the action and reaction of material activities? In answer to such questions, this verse explains that the material body of a liberated soul is taken charge of by the Supreme Personality of Godhead. It is no longer acting due to the living force of the living entity. It is simply acting as a reaction to past activities. That means the body now is simply there because of prarabdha karma, not even because there's a soul there. The soul is inside, but he's totally intoxicated, not even aware that he has the body. So now Prabhupada gives a very nice analogy. Even after being switched off, unfortunately we have no fans here, even after being switched off, an electric fan moves for some time. Anybody see it? Especially in India, you turn the fan on and it's going, then you turn it off. Even though the power is turned off, the blades still turn for some time until they stop. So by turning the power off means you cut off all the karma. You cut everything off. But by the movement, the momentum, the prarabdha karma, the blades still continue to turn. And eventually it just stops. That means all the prarabdha karma has been worn off. Now it may take more than one lifetime for the prarabdha karma to wear off. Multiple lifetimes. But that liberated soul doesn't care because he's not even aware that he has a body. Not even aware. There are two similar verses in the 11th canto which say the same thing. Just as a drunken man does not notice if he is wearing his coat or shirt, similarly one who is perfect in self-realization and who has thus achieved his eternal identity does not notice whether the temporary body is sitting or standing. Indeed, if by God's will the body is finished, or if by God's will he obtains a new body, a self-realized soul does not notice. This is a drunken man does not notice the situation of his outward dress. The material body certainly moves under the control of supreme destiny and therefore must continue to live along with the senses and vital air as long as one's karma is in effect. A self-realized soul, however, who is awakened to the absolute reality and who is thus highly situated in the perfect stage of yoga will never again surrender to the material body and its manifold manifestations, knowing it to be just like a body visualized in a dream. So you're getting the point. Here's another verse which corroborate the Vedanta, because the Bhagavatam is the natural commentary on the Vedanta Sutra. Let me just change my position here. I'm aware of my body. My body is thirsty now. It's from the 5th canto, 1st chapter, 16th verse. Even if one is liberated, he nevertheless accepts the body he has received according to his past karma. Because prarabdha karma, the actions, the the things which are associated with Prarabdha Karma may just be finished in one lifetime. It might take 10 lifetimes, may take 1,000 lifetimes to finish that karma which has already been put into action. But if you're liberated, it doesn't matter to you, because you're not holding onto the wheel. Krishna's got the wheel in his hand. And if one is liberated, he nevertheless accepts the body he has received according to his past karma. Without misconceptions, however, he regards his enjoyment and suffering due to that karma the way an awakened person regards a dream he had while sleeping. He thus remains steadfast and never works to achieve another material body under the influence of the three molds of material nature. So that's a... Then there's another nice this is from the prayers of the personified Vedas. First we'll read this one. One who engages in full devotional service, who does not fall down in any circumstance, at once transcends the modes of material nature and thus comes to the level of Brahman. That's Bhagavad Gita 14:26. Regardless of what one has done in our past lives, if we engage ourselves in unalloyed devotional service to the Lord in this life, we will always be situated in the Brahma Bhuta, liberated state, free from reactions, and will not be obligated to accept another material body. After giving up the body, one has to act in that way, does not accept another material body, but instead goes back home, back to Godhead. That's Srimad Bhagavatam 5.1.1.16. So this is from the prayers of the personified Vedas. Because Prabhupada, they give the example of one who is sleeping. How the living entity becomes liberated from material nature after surrendering unto the Supreme Personality of God is illustrated by a sleeping man within a room. When a man is sleeping, everyone sees that he is present within the room. But actually the man himself is not within that body. For while sleeping, a man forgets his bodily existence, although others may see that his body is present. Similarly, a liberated person engaged in devotional service of the Lord may be seen by others to be engaged in household duties of the material world. But since his consciousness is fixed in Krishna, he does not live within this world. His engagements are different, exactly as a sleeping man's engagements are different from his bodily engagements. So it goes on. This gives you an idea. So what happens, that even though we may have Prarabdha Karma is there, that our consciousness does not have to be fixed in it. If we're fixed in Krishna, then whatever our Prarabdha Karma is, it's of no consequence. If we are focused on Krishna, then that means we're not focused on our gross or subtle body, then we're not affected by whatever happens to the gross and subtle body. Karma is only in respect to our material body, which has got, you know, the gross and subtle aspect. So if you want to become free from karma, detach yourself from your body. Because it's only the soul is not affected by karma. So an objection may be raised that Srila Prabhupada allegedly stated that simply by clapping our hands in front of the deities, the lines in our hands change. You've heard that expression before. The purport that is drawn from this is that a devotee is immune to such things as astrology, palmistry, etc. The following question must then be answered by such an objector. In the history of spiritual life, many persons have fallen down. Indeed, Bhagavad Gita, chapter 6, verses 37 to 45 deals with this specific issue. Does this imply that such fallen, unsuccessful bhaktas did not clap hard enough? Like how hard do you have to have bruises on your hands after you finish clapping? No. After studying the conclusions of the Shastras, we see that indeed the lines do change by clapping in front of the deities. This change in the lines indicates a different future for the devotee, because by worshipping the Lord, all karmas, save and except Prarabdha karma, as noted above, gets eradicated. All the vast majority of karma gets destroyed. It's only the small part which has been put into action. Because, as we said, there's Sanchita karma, which is divided into Prarabdha and Arabdha. But then there's also Kriyamana karma. Kriyamana karma is newly created karma. So, a person who is completely involved in spiritual life, that Kriyamana karma does not cling to them. Just like water does not cling to a lotus leaf. Anybody see a leaf? It's very unstable. It can't cling. Or like water off a duck's back. It can't cling to the duck. But you, by your free will, remember, we have free will, we may choose to accept that karma. We may choose to get involved in that Kriyamana karma. That's our choice. We may choose to... We had turned off the switch of the fan, and then we might choose to turn the switch back on. That's our choice. We always have free will. Krishna, after explaining the whole Bhagavad Gita, he said to Arjuna, I've told you everything. Now you decide whether you want to listen to me or not. He didn't force Arjuna to do anything. Arjuna's free will, he decided. But Krishna explained everything. Then it's up to you to decide. He never forces. Another similar objection is that devotees are immune from astrology because astrology only deals with karma. Since devotees are immune from karma, they therefore are immune from astrology. That's an objection. This objection contains three fallacies. The first is the assumption that astrology is a causal agent from which one can be granted immunity. In other words, that astrology does something. Astrology doesn't do anything. Astrology just describes things. So you can't be immune from a description. Because astrology didn't cause you to be in any... like the barometer. I don't know if you were here yesterday. For those of you who were not here yesterday, I gave the example that when there's high pressure, the skies are clear, no rain. When there's low pressure, it gets all cloudy and rain falls, right? Everybody knows that, right? The weathermen tell you that. So you can measure if it's high pressure or low pressure. You make a barometer. So the needle goes up, that means high pressure. The needle goes down, it's low pressure. Does that mean that now that needle is what causes the rain to fall? Because the needle goes down, then for rain falls. Proof that the needle caused it to rain, isn't it? Is that correct? Therefore, if it doesn't rain, we should like do some puja to the barometer and placate the barometer. Then the needle will go down and then it'll rain. They should bring it to Saudi Arabia. They could use a little rain over there. But that's not how it works. The barometer doesn't cause anything to happen. The barometer isn't doing. All it tells you is what is the state of the air pressure. That's all it does. It doesn't create the air. It doesn't make the air pressure the way it is. It just tells you what the state of the air pressure is. But it didn't cause the air pressure to be that way. And it doesn't cause it to rain. Same thing with astrology. It just describes the situation. It doesn't cause it to happen. So that's one fallacy. And now we're already in another part of the book. This is from a chapter of a book I wrote, which I haven't published yet. The second fallacy is that astrology only deals with karma. This is disposed of because we see that astrology is a language which can describe any phenomena, including the divine personality of Godhead, Krishna. He had his horoscope done. Thirdly, the fallacy that devotees are immune to karma. And this has been, we already spent a lot of time detailing that. There was one devotee. He was going to get sannyas. He was going to take sannyas. I think it was in 1981. who's going to get to take sannyas. So he came to me. He asked me, you know, what my opinion was. And I looked at him. He was about 6'2", very handsome looking, tall, good looking. You know, I look at his palm, and he had like some marriage lines. And I said, I don't think it's a good idea for you to get married. For you to get take sannyas. I don't think it's a good idea. So he went and he asked his sannyas, the person who's going to be a sannyas guru, you know, about this. And the sannyas guru says, just forget about all this, you know, this is all nonsense. Yeah, you now that you're a devotee, you're immune from all these things, karma, astrology, etc., etc., etc. He took sannyas and he lasted about 4 years before, not only did he get married, he actually blooped and he became a very antagonistic toward ISKCON because of that. So there's another interesting fact. I'll just mention this one last thing, and then we'll get into some questions if anybody has any questions. It's called the vicarious atonement and dreams. Another way in which prarabdha karma may be destroyed is via vicarious atonement. Does anybody know what vicarious means? It's sort of like your father wanted always to be a lawyer, but he had to be a ditch digger. So what he put when he, but he worked really hard as a good ditch, made a lot of money, and he puts you, educates you, and he wants you to be a lawyer because he couldn't be one. That's called living vicariously. He wants you to be one. So another way in which prarabdha karma may be destroyed is via vicarious atonement, as explained in the Vedanta Sutra. This is quite rare, but apparently in different shakhas, recensions of the Vedas, namely the Kaushitakins and the Satyayanins, there is mention that in the case of extremely ardent lovers of Sri Krishna, vicarious atonement takes place. This means that the prarabdha karma of the Mahabhagavat is divided into papa and punya. That the papa karma, the evil karma, is given to his enemies to suffer. And the punya karma is given to his friends and relatives to enjoy. And thus the prarabdha karmas are still worked out, but by somebody else. And the body of the Mahabhagavat falls down, and he goes back to Godhead. So that's a very rare way of having your karmas worked off by somebody else. You know, all your good karma you give to your buddies, your bad karma goes to your enemies. But don't count on that. It's rare even for Mahabhagavats. Because for them, they don't really care. But it's just a rare situation because, you know, there's always an exception. There's always some exception. Nothing is ever straightforward. There's always some exception to every rule. In the purport to Srimad Bhagavatam 4.29.69, Srila Prabhupada states in regard to arabdha karma, seed-like, which is not yet manifested, that in some cases, because a Krishna-conscious person does not have it to accept a future gross body, his recorded desires are fulfilled in a dream. So you can also, certain karmas can be fulfilled in dreams. Of course, in the dream, it seems real while it's happening. People, you know, tigers chasing you, you get pretty scared. We suggest that this can also apply to prarabdha karma as well. Because of the obvious complexities of karma, it would be very difficult for the average spiritual person to understand exactly how all the rules of karma, with their intricate exceptions and convolutions, may be working at any given time. This is something that only Krishna can do. So we suggest that it would not, we would not expect that everybody to experience every facet of the possible combinations of karmic laws and all their exceptions in life. You know, because it's so complicated. As Krishna says, that the intricacies of action are very complex. And if Krishna says that, we should accept that is the fact. Very complicated, extremely complicated. So this discussion of prarabdha karma, while explaining to us the effects of fate, free will and the law of karma, from the individual entity's position itself raises new questions. The explanation of Vedanta Sutra and Srimad Bhagavatam seem to imply that all karma is a mechanical, automatic affair. The devotee, in order to be free from karma, engages in bhakti yoga, which eventually destroys all forms of karma, save and except prarabdha karma. At this point, a devotee, depending upon his level of advancement, either becomes oblivious to the remaining prarabdha karma by total non-identification with his material body and is completely absorbed in his spiritual nature, or the devotee simply bites the bullet, as it were, and patiently waits out until death. The devotee tries his best to maintain Krishna consciousness, all the while seeing everything as Krishna's mercy. In this whole scenario, Krishna is seemingly left out, except as the object of meditation. After all, self-realization is reciprocal. We realize that we are not the body, but the soul. And beyond that, we realize that we are servants of Sri Krishna. And out of love, we serve Him. And simultaneously, Krishna's devotion towards us increases. So the legitimate question may be asked, what is Krishna doing in regards to the devotee and his experiences of prarabdha karma? What's he doing in all this? Some persons may object that so far the discussion has been such as to give the impression that Krishna doesn't interact or help his devotee. So, now we want to get into this. We would like to view the subject from a different perspective so as to clear this matter and show that there's no contradiction. Rather, the subject is so large and complex that it is difficult to see all the facets at one time. Is the devotee just left to his own resources to deal with his prarabdha karma by performing devotional service and by so doing become inured to it, or does Krishna intervene? At what point does the remaining prarabdha karma become replaced by the Lord's special mercy? Or is the prarabdha karma itself special mercy? By this I mean the distressful condition that some devotees are seen to be in. For example, the Pandavas is not a result of their karma, for they are nitya siddhas, eternally liberated. The distressed condition that they experience is part of their leela, pastime in relationship with the Lord. Is there some point in time where a great sadhana siddha bhakta is experiencing distress or happiness which is not a result of his prarabdha karma? If so, when and how can they be distinguished from the more pedestrian strain of events which are fueled by karma? These are all good questions. So there are some references that indicate that Krishna minimizes the karmic reactions and intervenes in the life of the devotee. These references are sometimes used as an argument to prove that devotees can do anything, even things they are not qualified for, because Krishna will minimize or change their karma. And here's where I gave that example about the young man who was being inducted into the spiritual order of sannyas. He consulted me and I told him that he was unsuited for this vow at this time in his life. He reported this back to a senior devotee who told him to ignore what I said, because now that he was a devotee, he was immune to his karma. That Krishna had changed it all and destroyed or minimized all the negative aspects. Hearing such strong words, the young man ignored my warnings and took sannyas. He only lasted 4 years as a sannyasi. This type of approach that Krishna must reduce, person's karma because that person is a devotee, seems uncomfortably close to the Purva Mimamsaka Darshan, commonly known as Karma Mimamsaka philosophy of Jaimini. In this philosophy, the aspirant is just encouraged to perform good works according to the direction of the Veda, and he is guaranteed to get good results. There is no need for separately worshipping God, for by the law of karma, it doesn't matter if God is worshipped or not, because the result he gets is dependent on the work that he does and not the grace of God. So the approach that some devotees seem to have is that Krishna has no free will of his own. Krishna has no free will. He has to give it. No, he doesn't. Why? He's supremely independent. If we have free will, we speak of Krishna as free will. Right? So So they seem to have that Krishna has no free will of his own, that he must minimize the devotee's karma for the simple reason that the devotee is performing devotional service. This is absurd. If we have a small and minuscule amount of independence, then what to speak of Krishna, who is unlimitedly and supremely independent? He can do as he likes. So let's look at a few of... Krishna has a few options. Now, Krishna might decrease the devotee's distress, either out of his causeless mercy or in answer to the helpless prayers of his devotee. There are numerous examples of such a case, like the case of Ajimil, Sudama Vipra, Gajendra, Moksha Lila, as Lord Krishna states in the Gita. But those who always worship me with exclusive devotion, meditating on my transcendental form, to them I carry what they lack, and I preserve what they have. So then, we can also look at 1866. Another option is he could increase the distress, right? Out of his causeless mercy, or to teach the devotee a specific lesson to rectify him, while there's hope that the Lord would decrease the devotee's miseries, some are surprised that he might increase them. But the Supreme Lord is independent and he may act as he likes for his own good reasons. For example, in the Bhagavatam, Krishna says, if I especially favor a devotee and especially wish to care for him, the first thing I do is I take away his riches. Makes you broke, right? Then the devotee becomes a penniless pauper or is put into a comparatively poverty-stricken position. Relatives and family members no longer take interest in him, and in most cases they give up connection with him. The devotee then becomes doubly unhappy. So Krishna increases your misery on purpose. This is what the Avanti Brahmana states, 11th canto, 23rd chapter, verse 28. The Supreme Personality of Godhead, Lord Hari, who contains within himself all the demigods, must be satisfied with me. Indeed, he has brought me to this suffering condition and forced me to experience detachment, which is the boat to carry me over this ocean of material suffering. Because the Avanti Brahmana was very wealthy, but then Krishna, one by one, he stole everything from him. Everything was, his house burnt down, his family rejected him, until he had nothing. Then he thought about it and thought about it and says, oh, actually Krishna must be really happy with me. He gave me this blessing. He realized that all this misery was actually a blessing. There's also an apocryphal story. I don't know if it's true or not, but whether it's true or not, the lesson is very interesting. Supposedly, there's one great Mahabhagavat living in South India. He had a disease, and he was very painful, discomforting disease. And he was praying to Krishna, but nothing happened. He didn't get better. But then he came to this powerful astrologer, very learned astrologer, and he asked for the astrologer's condition. What should he do? So the astrologer, figured out some remedial measure, told him what to do, and he did it, and he became cured. Then he went to temple, finally he was well enough. He could go to the temple, and he went to the Krishna, and he prayed to him, and said, Krishna, why? What happened? What's going on? And then Krishna said to him, says, actually, I wanted you to die, and then you would come back home, back to Godhead. But now that you've done this, it's going to take you 3 more lifetimes. You'll have to take 3 more lifetimes because you did this. You were to come home, but now you did this. Everything Krishna does is for our benefit. We may not understand it, but it's for our good. So he tried, he didn't know that Krishna had his own plan, and he changed the thing. So whether it's true or not, the idea is that Krishna knows what's best for us. Even though we may think that he should change the way, the street method of treatment, but he knows exactly what we need. We're almost running out of time here. There's one, another. There's a verse from the Bhagavad Gita, 9:22. Ananyas chintayanto mam ye janah parupasate Tesham yukta biyuktanam yoga kshema vaham yaham. But to those who always worship me with exclusive devotion, meditating on my transcendental form, to them I carry what they lack and I preserve what they have. That's Bhagavad Gita 9.22. So Prabhupada tells a very humorous story regarding this verse. I think it's either, he mentions Arjunacharya and Yamunacharya. So this is what Prabhupada says. So these two things the Lord takes charge, that I personally do it for whom? Ananyas chintayanto mam, those who have no other thought than Krishna, Krishna consciousness. Ananyas chintayanto mam ye jana parupasate, and engaged in that way always. He has no other business, simply Krishna. For him, these things the Lord does. It is specifically mentioned here. Therefore, this is an encouragement. That is an encouragement by the Lord, that do not think that because you are not trying for going to the other planet, you will be unhappy. You will always have happiness. What is happiness? Happiness is within your mind. If you are assured of your peaceful existence and the next life, you are transferred to the supreme planet or supreme place, then that is happiness. Not for trying life after life to adjust happiness. Here is an assurance. Now this Arjunacharya, that's a very nice story. When he was writing commentaries, oh, he thought, how that Lord will come himself and deliver the goods. Oh, it is not possible. He might be sending through some agent. So he wanted to cut Vahami Aham. I bear the burden and deliver. He wrote in a way that I send some agent who delivers. So that Arjunacharya went to take a bath. And in the meantime, two boys, very beautiful boys, they brought some very nice foodstuffs in large quantity. And in India, there is a process to taking two sides burden on the bamboo. Just like a scale, it is balanced. So these two boys brought some very highly valuable foodstuff and grains and ghee. And his wife was there. And the boy said, "My dear mother, Arjunacharya has sent these goods to you. Please take delivery." "Oh, you are so nice boy. You are so beautiful boys. And he has given? The Acharya is not so cruel. How is that? He has given so much burden to you? He is not kind. Oh, I was not taking. And just see, he has beaten me. Here is a cane mark. Oh, see." The little boys are showing that they've been beaten. They got marks all over their bodies. "Oh, see." His wife became very much astonished that Acharya is not so cruel. How he has become so cruel. So she was thinking in that way. Then, "All right, my dear boys, you come on," and gave him shelter. "And I shall go because Arjunacharya again comes. He will chastise us." They were afraid that he's going to beat them again. No, sit down, take foodstuff." She prepared foodstuff and then went away. Then Arjunacharya came back. Then he saw that his wife was eating, because it is the system of Indian families that after the husband has taken the food, the wife will take. So they don't eat together. After the family members, the boys and the husband eat sumptuously, then the housewife takes. So the wife said, "Acharya, you become so much cruel nowadays?" "Oh, how is that?" he's asking. Like, "Well, what are you talking about?" "Two boys, very nice boys. They have brought so many foodstuff. You lord it on their head and they deny to take it. And you have beaten them, chastised." He said, "No, I have never done this. Why shall I do it?" Then she described, "Oh, such nice, beautiful boys." And Arjunacharya understood that because I wanted that God does not deliver, so he has delivered these goods. And because I cut those alphabets, that he does not give it personally, so he has shown that beating marks on his back. There is an incident, so this is how Prabhupada did. Krishna actually does it. Krishna actually reciprocates with a devotee in this way. So we're almost at the end. I can take one question. Anybody has a question?
Prabhu, it seems sometimes like Krishna could help the devotee, a living entity, not to get involved in karma. But it still sometimes is allowed, even though the consequence of those actions will sometimes protect the body's life, the person's life. Yeah. So how come Krishna being the supreme controller, couldn't he do a bit more for the living entity?
No, it has to be a Krishna in the whole Bhagavad Gita. He explains the whole Bhagavad Gita, and then he tells Arjuna, I explain everything to you, now you think about it, and you make your own decision. You have free will.
Yeah, but in the case
No. That's the way. It's like, how can you have love? I put a gun to your head and say, love me. It's not love anymore,
I'm
right?
I refer more like a father and a child. If you see...
Then you can be like Rupa Goswami. You can be like Rupa Goswami then, who prays to Krishna, Krishna, you are a cowherd boy. And cowherd boys carry sticks in their hand. So if the cow goes off the path, he beats the stick. He beats the cow. So he prays to Krishna, that you please beat me, so that I stay on the right path. So you can pray that way. But don't complain if Krishna beats you. You might get a good beating. You might get what you prayed for. He might, to keep you on the straight path, he might do things which you might not have bargained for. Right? So be careful what you pray for. But Rupa Goswami does pray that way. You are a cowherd boy, please beat me with that stick and make sure I don't go off the path. Prays to be beaten. Any other questions? He was first. He was.
Okay. Thank you, Master. I'd like to know how it is when misfortune comes to us. Misfortunes, the same thing, send us misfortunes, communicate to us. And so can evil forces send us misfortunes. How do we know?
Well, unfortunately, the Arctic is going to happen. Have to save it for another time.